every hour, every 7 hours a day in the middle of June. It's going to get worse in July. Now remember, under Saddam Hussein, the electricity worked. I'm not praising Saddam Hussein, folks. What I'm trying to get across is we're not doing any better. The situation for the Iraqi people has deteriorated, and for Americans, it's even worse. One employee informed us in March, this is paragraph 10 of the memo, that his brother-in-law had been kidnapped. Paragraph 11, the demeanor of the guards to the green zone at their checkpoints are becoming more militia-like, in some cases seemingly taunting. Paragraph 12, Iraqi colleagues do not feel they can speak English openly. Paragraph 13, they cannot call employees at home without blowing their cover. Paragraph 14, they cannot use American cell phones. It makes them a target. The list goes on and on and on, but the important thing about this memo is it's just talking about American employees. It's just talking about those working for us in the U.S. Embassy. If it's that bad for Americans working for us, think how it is for ordinary Iraqis. And of course, think how it is for our troops. We now have 2,500 dead for this war in Iraq. 2,500 dead, some 20,000 wounded. Again, the newspaper reports and shows us the pictures. But it's not about the pictures. It's about their individual lives. And the question is, what are we fighting for? And the president still won't tell us. What's interesting is that we now know, though some of us didn't know then, that it could not have been about weapons of mass destruction. After all, the most evil and awful weapon of mass destruction is nuclear weapons, and the president stood aside while North Korea got nuclear weapons. And we know that the president had no idea where they were. Here we had, of course, Donald Rumsfeld say on Meet the Press he knew exactly where Iraq's nuclear weapons were, but now we know it wasn't true. How do we know this? Internal memos. The Downing Street memo. The Downing Street memo made it clear that the president fixed the facts around the policy. Another direct quote. You understand what that means. It means that he didn't have any facts to back up his war. He changed the facts to get us into war. We know from Paul O'Neill, who wrote in Ron Susskind's book, The Price of Loyalty, we've seen that secret memo, the one on January 30th, 2001, 10 days into the Bush administration, the map of Iraq, divided up into various oil fields. And it all starts to make sense. This is an administration that rewards those people that brought it to power. No, not you, the voters. Are you kidding me? They don't care about the voters. We're talking about who gives them money. That's how Congress works. That's how the president works. You have to pay to play. Money is the mother's milk of politics, and if you haven't given your latest $1 million donation to the president, don't expect to get a billion back in return. Though I have to tell you, it's a great investment, right? Put a million down, get a billion back. Dennis Hastert, the Speaker of the House, has done very well investing in graft and corruption. The Speaker of the House, the man that Republicans vote for to run the House, people like Tom Davis and Frank Wolf put their trust in this man. Well, he, interestingly enough, in 2004, bought a little property in the Chicago area. And then, over the next year, he earmarked $207 million for a parkway just 5 miles away from his property. Guess what? Within a year, he sold his land for a $2 million profit. Now, you and I can't do that, of course, because, heck, we don't control the purse of the United States. But the Republicans do, and they've done it very well. Now, I'm not saying there aren't corrupt Democrats as well. There certainly are. William Jefferson of Louisiana is an extremely corrupt Democrat. But the Democrats, to their credit, have found he's corrupt and pushed him aside. In fact, this week, William Jefferson was forced off his committee, the Ways and Means Committee. He was asked to resign by the Democratic leadership. He refused. But they've done everything they can to get him out of power. Compare that with, say, Tom DeLay or Dennis Hastert or any of the other people running the pay-for-play system in Congress. They're not doing the same thing, right? You know, of course, Dennis Hastert was cited 3 times for ethical violations. He was indicted. And the Republicans responded by saying, indicted people should be running our government. People who are charged with corruption should be running our government. This kind of bribery should be legal. But They're not going to talk about ethics. They're not going to talk about how we can change this pay-for-play system. No, we're not going to talk about that. Instead, they're going to talk about how to prevent gay people from marrying and why it should be changed in our Constitution so you can't burn a flag. That is what they're focusing on. And, well, I think differently. If you want to call in, by the way, and have your voice heard, I'm going to have Mike Lane here in just a few minutes. Now, Mike Lane, he works to get Republicans elected. I firmly believe that the other side should always be heard. That's why I have him on my show. And I want to hear from you. If you want to call in and have your voice heard, just pick up the phone and dial 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Agree or disagree, that's your right. And we'll be right back with your calls and my guest Mike Lane right after these messages.
If you're concerned that we're becoming a nation whose policies are grounded in beliefs that are centered on a lie and embedded in BS, then you won't want to miss the all-new program coming to Cox Channel 10, Escape from Orwellian Nation. Uncle Sam wants you to watch. Coming this summer. History has demonstrated that violence only begets greater violence. And injustice only begets greater injustice. This is not the tradition of our great nation. This is not how we want the United States to be known around the world. We have another tradition that we think ought to prevail. One that is more just and more powerful. There is a better way. If we truly want peace and security, then we must work hard for justice. In 2004, there were 203 million eligible voters in the United States. Of these, nearly 70% did not vote for George W. Bush. Only 62 million voters, or barely 30% of those eligible, actually voted for the president in 2004. Recent polls show the president's approval ratings slipping into the low 30% range. This comes as a little surprise to many of the 70% of eligible voters who did not vote for him.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. And one of the things I believe in, as strongly as I believe the things you heard me say just a few minutes ago, is that all of our ideas, mine, yours, my guest here, all of our ideas should be open for debate. One of the things I think that most distresses me about the current administration is their tendency to close down debate, to say that you cannot discuss these ideas. Well, one person I know who is never afraid to debate, and that's why I'm always glad to have him on, is my friend Mike Lane here. He is the president of Intellifence Strategies. He works to get Republicans elected in Congress, which may be pretty hard to do this year. Mike Lane, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Mark, it's a pleasure to be back. Thank you for having me.
Well, I understand you were stuck in the rain on the way getting here.
For our viewers, it's the storm of the season.
It is.
And, it took me a little bit longer than I had anticipated.
Now, do you think if the Virginia legislature would give us better transportation, you might have an easier job getting here,
Mike? I think really what we need is some weather control on this one.
I don't think
anything was going to get me through this.
All right, fair enough. Folks, if you want to call in, the toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Mike, before you came, I was talking about the war in Iraq and the fact that the very first debate ever held in the United States Congress since we went to war 4 years ago was held just last week. And they debated 11 hours over a resolution. I happen to have a copy of the resolution right here. That basically ends saying, declared that the United States will prevail in the global war on terror, the noble struggle to protect freedom from the terrorist adversary.
Now, very noble words, aren't they?
Well, you know, the Republicans, your party, draft these things.
Yes, they did. The majority party drafts, and we happen to be the majority party.
That's true. You happen to be the majority party, and you draft these things. And instead of having a debate over, you know, whether or not we need to leave Iraq, whether or not we're succeeding in Iraq, talking about things like this memo that the Washington Post disclosed showing an increasing civil war danger even for the employees of the Green Zone, we get this kind of rhetoric like, declares the United States will prevail in the global war on terror, the noble struggle to protect freedom from the terrorist adversary. And we get this kind of language, and we get debates on flag burning and whether gay people can marry, instead of talking really about a plan to deal with Iraq. I think they're basically hiding the ball and hiding from the tough issues of the day. Do you agree?
Well, we have a plan, Mark. It's called We Win, They Lose. That's the bottom line. That's the way we finish this, and that's what that resolution said. Now, as you know, the place for debate in our Congress, according to our system, the way it's set up, is really in the Senate. The House was perceived as a place where there'd be a little bit of, hothead emotionalism, things like that.
Well, there's definitely that now.
The majority party controls the flow, controls the words, and most important, they control the Rules Committee. And whereas most committees are divided on the percentage ratio of the way the House is divided, the Rules Committee, as started by the Democrats, I believe, back in the late 70s or early 80s, decided that the majority party would control the Rules Committee 2-1 so that whatever rule the leadership wanted for debate, the leadership would have. So in the House, you're going to get a resolution drafted by the majority. It's going to be debated and voted on according to the rules that are imposed by the majority, and you're not going to get on any issue, whether it's the war or anything else, that you get in the Senate. Now, we did have a debate in the Senate on the war as well, and as I understand, Senator Kerry and his cohorts lost that one 93-6 or
Actually,
something
yes,
like that.
The McConnell bill that the Kentucky senator put off did lose 93-6. Of course, Kerry didn't put forward that bill, as you know, but one of the main differences between the Democrats when they ran Congress, the Republicans. The Democrats allowed for something called amendments, which people at home, you may think, because maybe you read your social studies textbook, that if the majority of the members of Congress want something, it becomes law. You've been reading the wrong textbook. You've probably been reading your Constitution. It doesn't apply, as Mike and I both know. The way it works is, according to Dennis Hastert, the Speaker of the House, a majority of Republicans must want legislation. So basically the way it works is a majority of the majority party, which could be 26%, frankly, given how few people vote these days, it's probably 6% of you or something like that, that decides whether something gets heard. You could have something, we had legislation, for example, we had a caller that called about voting machines. We had legislation still available, Rush Holt of New Jersey, who wants fraud-proof voting machines, wants voting machines that are not susceptible to fraud. That's legislation that if it were actually voted on, I'm confident we could get 400 votes, or at least a good two-thirds of Congress. It will never come to a vote as long as Republicans are in power, because a majority of Republicans don't support it. Mike, do you think that Congress should be run by the majority in that body, or should it be run by the majority of the majority, so in essence Hastert or DeLay gets to decide all the legislation that goes through?
Well, it's not Hastert or DeLay. As we both know, Mr. DeLay left Congress last week, so he's no longer there, and his influence was, in fact, non-existent for the last 6 months after he stepped down as leader. The real issue is in how do you run a legislative body of 435 people efficiently. You don't give each and every last backbencher the opportunity to offer their 15 perfecting amendments, because you'll be there for 2 years and you'll never pass a single piece of legislation.
And so obviously
you've got to have a rule, and the rule typically is for something that's a non-binding resolution like this was, that there's no amendments, it's up or down. On significant pieces of legislation, I will grant you, there typically is an opportunity for the minority to offer an amendment, either an amendment to the main vehicle or an amendment in the nature of a substitute. And more recently, there has been less opportunity for minority to do that.
Definitely.
I personally would hope that they would give them more opportunity, because I think they can vote them down.
Well, I think the answer is if you put an idea forward and let the Congress decide whether it's good or not. We have not had for 4 years a debate on Iraq. We've had the President of the United States.
Well, we had an 11-hour debate.
Wait, the first time in 4 years. Now, maybe flag burning is more of an issue to you out there than whether or not 2,500 Americans who are dead in Iraq died for a good cause, whether 20,000 wounded. I happen to think that what's going on in Iraq is more important than a spate of flag burning. But you know, the Republicans in Congress have determined that flag burning brings us votes, talking about the war in Iraq doesn't. And this was something that was, as you know, was very much forced on them by the Democrats, and then they turned it to try to argue it was about a global war on terror.
Well, there's no doubt that that the vote on the flag and the vote on marriage and things like that, the outcome was predictable. We knew where it was going, and it was simply an exercise, which both parties do when they have the majority, of establishing a vehicle for members to be on record so they can go home and tell the voters why they voted a certain way. Politics, you know, I mean, I'm shocked and appalled that politics would actually happen on the floor of the House of Representatives. Shocked and appalled that that would happen.
If flag burning were done in addition to taking care of gas prices and health care and the fact that people haven't had a minimum wage increase in 7 years and are working harder just to stay around, and we're actually dealing with a real plan to stop us from being hated all around the world for torturing people, for secret prisons, if it were something dealing with the fact that we're becoming a police state spying on American citizens, and they threw in flag burning, and they threw in a marriage amendment, so fine, they do it. But as you know, the do-nothing Congress under Harry Truman, the one that he won the election, this do-nothing Congress, they worked about 100-something days. This Congress has worked less, Mark. 95 days. They are more do-nothing than doing nothing Congress. And I don't think it's because we don't have issues that are concerned about. I think it's because this Congress would rather focus on flag burning than on all the other issues.
You know what, Mark? Once upon a time, as you know, perhaps some of our viewers have heard it before, many have not. Once upon a time, in a previous life, I wore the uniform of our country. I was active duty for 3 years in the United States Marine Corps, and I spent another 18 in the reserve. As a young lieutenant leading an infantry platoon, the last thing I wanted was my captain micromanaging the way my platoon was run. And the last thing my captain wanted was the lieutenant colonel, battalion commander, micromanaging how the company was run. The last thing anybody over in Iraq wants is the Congress micromanaging the way the war is going to be run. And that's why once the Congress made the decision that we were going to go to war, it then becomes the joint responsibility of the military services, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the SINCs, and the Commander-in-Chief, the President of the United States, to prosecute that war and to win it. It's not Congress's job to debate when or when not we might have a withdrawal strategy. We withdraw when we win.
We withdraw when we win. So in your view, we should still be in Vietnam, right?
We haven't won yet. Well, no, that's right.
And if it takes 30 years, 50 years, 100 years, we should be in Iraq permanently, right?
Well, you know what? There's another time when you withdraw, and that's when you lose. And we lost the Vietnam War, and we lost it because Congress micromanaged it and did this and did that and said we couldn't do this.
We can still invade now, can we do it?
Well, we're not going to because we're friends with Vietnam now.
We're friends with Vietnam now. You're telling me that we left having lost the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the government of Vietnam, which is no great shakes, is actually dealing with us, actually trading with us. And actually, by leaving Vietnam, we were able to accomplish more of our goals than if we stayed. How interesting. Shouldn't that debate be said in Iraq?
And lo and behold, after 27 years of holding our Marines and other Americans hostage in Iran, the mullahs, the ayatollah, and the government of Iran is now reaching out to us and wanting to deal with us again, too. This president is amazing the way he's working this diplomacy.
I see. And Iran wants to deal with us because we invaded them.
No, Iran wants to invade them. They don't want to be invaded.
Interesting.
They know it's coming.
You know what? They say, your party always says Ronald Reagan won the Cold War.
He did.
But I don't recall us invading Moscow. Now, maybe I was just asleep the day we invaded Moscow in the several years that we occupied the Soviet Union, but I don't think we did that. In fact, I think history has shown that whether it's South Africa or Libya or other countries, that we actually can get our way without invasion. And that perhaps Saddam Hussein would have been better off, and his country would have been better off, if we had contained him as we had him contained. Then people wouldn't be worried about their lives. They would still have electricity. They would still have water. And we could do something even better. We could focus our resources in going after the people that murdered 3,000 Americans who are still on the loose in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And isn't it wonderful that Ronald Reagan won that Cold War without firing a single shot, without having to invade Moscow? He did it through diplomacy, and he did it through peace, through strength.
It's a shame that Bush
can't do that. It's a wonderful thing.
Yes, it is. It's a shame that Ronald Reagan, who was not a president I was a big fan of, compared to President Bush, I agree. He was an amazing leader.
Mr. Gorbachev was a little bit more rational than was Saddam Hussein.
Why was Bush so determined, even before negotiating with Saddam Hussein, even before even discussing the issue of sanctions or war, he was determined to go to war. Why was he so determined that he was actually willing to change the facts and lie to the American people to get us into war, as the Downing Street memo is now?
I don't think he was anxious to go to war. I think if Saddam had complied with the UN resolutions and proved beyond a shadow of a doubt as to what happened to all the chemical weapons and the nuclear weapons program, which we knew he had because we saw it ourselves back in 91 when we were there, if he had complied, then everything would have been fine. There would have been no need for this whole thing.
You're actually arguing we invaded Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction. You're still making that argument.
We invaded to enforce the UN resolutions.
To enforce the UN resolutions. The UN itself did not feel should be enforced.
You know what?
We decided to take on... We did it all for the UN. That's why we're in Iraq, protect the United Nations. I thought that Republicans argued that we shouldn't just go into a war to protect the United Nations, but that's why we're there?
No, we did it to protect our own interests. We were enforcing enforcing the United Nations resolutions.
That the United Nations determined they didn't want to enforce.
And I will agree. The UN was incredibly disappointing, but now that John Bolton's there as ambassador, they're starting to get a little bit more of a backbone. He's doing an excellent job, and the UN is starting to come around. They have a lot of progress to make, but we'll see how they come.
I like you, but you're all talking points. This is all talking points.
No,
it's not the reality.
It's true.
Look, Paul O'Neill, former Treasury Secretary, has shown us the document. January 30th, 2001, Bush, Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, they're sitting in a room, they got a map of Iraq, and they're dividing it. This oil field goes to this company, this oil field goes to that company, this oil field goes to that company. You've seen the document, you know it exists. Why were they doing that on January 30th, 2001?
I don't even know that that happened. And the reason is, if that was going to happen, why haven't these oil fields gone to this company? And why haven't those? Do you think for 1 minute that if Exxon was given a couple oil fields over there, which they're not going to be done, do you think for 1 minute that they were given that they couldn't put together a private security force, go over there and keep that oil flowing? Of course they could.
Yes, because we are not going to be able to permanently occupy and conquer Iraq.
And we have no intention to, and we don't want to.
Sure we do.
No, we don't.
Okay, why is it that George Bush has refused to say something it'd be very easy for him to say, which is we have no intention of having permanent military bases in Iraq? He's never said that.
You don't tip your hand. You know, you don't tell them what's going on. And in fact, we might have. You know what? We had no intention at World War II of having permanent military bases in Japan and Germany.
Different.
And here we are. Here we are 65 years later, and we're still occupying Germany.
And you know the difference? Germans want us there. They may not soon.
And
98% of them know about Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. And so they may not want us there. In fact, we're actually ruining our services all across.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you something. We got a phone call, but we're about to go to a break. So hang on, Gordon from Michigan. I want to hear from you. But first, we're going to have to take a break. Mike, when we come back, I want to try to deal with the reality of where we are today. Okay, we are occupying a country that doesn't want us there. And I don't know about you, but when I think back to the American Revolution and the fact that we didn't want to be occupied by the British, I can sympathize with some of those Iraqis. If you agree or disagree, give us a call. We'll be right back after this.
This is Mommy's bed. Me and Jenny were jumping on it. Mommy's gun fell on the floor. I was a cowboy. Bang, 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 bang. I said, Jenny, wake up, wake up. It's just pretend. But she wouldn't wake up.
If you give me a fish...
If you give someone a fish...
You feed them for a day.
Teach someone to fish.
You feed them for a lifetime.
Give me a fish, and you'll feed me for a day. Teach me to fish, and you'll feed me for a lifetime.
Through Volunteers of America, you can help change lives in your community.
Hey, Mr. Studied algebra in school and got a better job than I could. You take the last call.
Oh, no, Mr. Stuck in an entry-level job because you only learned basic math. I don't have a boss riding my butt like you do, so you take it so you can get back to your desk.
You know, I probably should, but maybe Miss AP Calculus with the $200 haircut in the big office upstairs would like a cup.
Oh, no, Mr. What was your name again? Never mind, it doesn't matter. I'm too busy doing important things to care. I just came down for some sweetness, sir.
You know, if my limited math abilities weren't keeping me from getting a better job, I'd quit this afternoon.
I don't blame you. But thank goodness you're stuck here, because we really need someone to make the coffee.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Have we learned the lessons of Vietnam, or are we doomed to repeat them? Well, one of my callers right now I know is a Vietnam vet. Gordon from Michigan, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hi, Mark. I'd like to ask Mike, how long does he think the Republican Party can operate as a majority in Congress trying to sell a war in Iraq that right now about 70% of the American people don't agree with?
Can I answer that question in mid-November? that's an excellent question, Gordon. I think that, clearly the presidential election in 2004 was an election that the Republicans hoped would turn on a referendum of the president's handling of the war. The Democratic candidate, Mr. Kerry, was all too glad to fight the president for a while on that particular issue, and it turned out that the voters not only returned a Republican majority, but increased, particularly in the Senate, by a large margin, the Republican majority.
If you trust the voting machines, I'd like to talk a little bit later on in this broadcast about Robert Kennedy's article in the Rolling Stone, which I think lays out very clearly the case that John Kerry actually won that election. But go ahead. That's a separate issue, which we'll get to.
Rolling Stone is not on my every week read list. However, I will note that their 1,000th cover did come out this week. And so happy anniversary to Rolling Stone.
Happy anniversary to Rolling Stone. Go ahead. I know Gordon has more for you.
Gordon, the other thing is, from everything we read, and I will candidly admit I haven't had cocktails with Karl Rove since the prosecutor certified him innocent. But he has signaled that
certified
he is again
him innocent.
He has signaled again.
Decided he would not press charges because they apparently couldn't prove it. Let's not say he's innocent.
He has signaled again that the 2006 strategy is going to make it another referendum on the war. He has access to a lot more information than I do. At this point, I would say I'm confident that if the debate on the war takes place in the campaign and not on the floor of the House, that ultimately majorities of Republicans will be returned to both the House and the Senate. However, I would be perfectly willing to re-answer that question the first Wednesday in November.
Gordon, take it away. Anything else?
Well, I'd like to say something about the Karl Rove thing. I think Karl Rove is not completely off the hook yet. As long as there's testimony to be pursued in the Libya investigation, I think he's still hanging on the hook there.
I'll tell you, he's also on the hook, Vice President Dick Cheney. We now know that Dick Cheney had a coordinated campaign to discredit Joe Wilson, Ambassador Joe Wilson, for telling the truth to the American people about the president's lie. Again, another clear lie. The president knew that Saddam wasn't getting nuclear weapons out of Niger and lied to the American people. And Cheney decided he was going to punish Joe Wilson. That's a fact. And whether the special prosecutor can prove Cheney's fingerprints, I don't know yet. We'll have to see at Scooter Libby's trial.
Well, look, first of all, this Fitzpatrick guy, he's a prosecutor that makes Ken Starr look like a pussycat. I mean, this guy is tough. He's aggressive.
I haven't seen him investigate Rove sex life yet.
This guy is a prosecutor's prosecutor. He has left no stone unturned.
Did you check the hairstyle? Because they went after Clinton's hairstyle. They went after his sex life. They went after, they checked out whether he was on the plane for too long while he was getting his hair done. I haven't seen this prosecutor do the frivolous stuff that Ken Starr's done. In fact, I have to think this prosecutor, frankly, is being a little too, pardon the word, conservative in the sense that I don't think he's going after this guy enough.
Well, the general press seems to be that he's a hard nose. So in any event.
I hope so.
In any event, Rove's off the hook. Never was anything there. Never going to be anything there, not going
to
come out in any of the trials for Scooter Libby.
Let me ask you something. It may be true that they can't prove Karl Rove committed perjury. Rove's line is, I forgot I talked to the press when I came in and told the prosecutors that I never had. Okay, I forgot about my conversation with the Time reporter. All right, maybe they can't prove him for perjury. They couldn't prove Bill Clinton committed perjury either. But he said, it depends on what the definition of is. But Bill Clinton when he lied to the American people or misstated, saying he didn't have sexual relations when he had another kind of sexual act, when he played that way, Republicans handed him his head. We know that Rove lied to the American people. How do we know this? Because Scott McClellan came out there and said, I looked Rove in the eye. He denied any involvement in this. And for several years, Rove never corrected that statement. Okay, he knew that a lie was going out. Even if you can't punish him for perjury, do you think that a presidential advisor who knowingly lies to the American people about something as severe as outing a CIA agent, which George Bush's father has called treason, do you think that he should be punished for wagging his finger, if you will, and lying to the American people, or only if they can get him for perjury?
Well, first of all, let's correct the premise. Valerie Plame was not a covert agent at the time, so he didn't out anybody in accordance with anything.
Not according to Fitzgerald. Well, not according to her colleagues. Not according to her neighbors. Not according to everyone who worked with her.
You know, according to everybody.
Not according to the CIA.
Every one of her neighbors knew she worked for the CIA.
Not true.
And
not
she hadn't been undercover. She hadn't been in the covert status for 6 years.
That's not true. I don't know what articles you've been reading, but the CIA, I mean, I had Larry. Oh, I forgot his last name. I had him on my show.
Oh, the guy on MSNBC, Larry Democrat, right?
No. He's a worker. He's independent. He works for the CIA. Her neighbors did not know. They're Washington Post articles. They've interviewed her neighbors. They didn't know. That talking point just doesn't fly.
Well, everything I read in the Washington Post that she was flaunting it, you know, it was well known, et cetera.
Okay,
so,
well, here's what I'm asking, Mike, since you can really defend this talking point. Right. Name one person outside the CIA who knew she was a CIA agent.
Well, give me your computer. We'll Google up the Washington Post and we'll find it out.
I'll tell you what. I want you to post it on my website after the show. Okay?
I'll do that.
I want you to find the name, because I don't think you'll find a single name other than her husband of an individual outside the CIA who didn't, you know, also have a top secret clearance who knew about her activities.
All right.
And I don't think it was well known.
We'll
find
out.
I know people say that, but they can't find anyone who actually knew.
We'll find out. I'll post it to your website. If you'll take it, I'll give it to you.
Absolutely, and we'll post it. And folks, if you want to post on the website, and maybe you don't want to call in, you can do that at www.radioinsidescoop.com. I want to talk a little bit more about Iraq, though, because it seems to me that the debate, this 11-hour debate, really is disingenuous. It's not a real debate over Iraq. You had Bill Frist in the Senate get up there and saying, you know, we're not going to cut and run.
Right.
Okay? Instead of talking about whether we're succeeding in Iraq, whether we're going anywhere, whether we're moving forward, whether we're moving backward, and I think even the U.S. Embassy would agree off the record that we're moving backwards. They told the president to that effect. They're using these terms like cut and run, which suggests, if Bill Frist, and maybe you agree with this, that any time we get into a war, we can never leave. That in essence, whether it's Vietnam or Somalia or Iraq, that if we get into a war, even if it's done based on a lie, even if it's done based on things that aren't true, we can never, ever leave unless, I don't know, how many deaths? 10,000, 20,000? When is it
well,
ever?
Well, Vietnam was 56.
Well, is that what it takes?
It takes whatever it takes to stay there and win, Mark. You know, one of the things that has been attributed to Osama, and I'm being careful now because I don't have the Washington Post article in front of me, one of the things that's attributed to him as to how and why he made the decision to attack the United States was he didn't think we had the stomach to retaliate. He didn't think we had the stomach to stick it out based on his experience of observing us in Vietnam. So if we were willing to not prosecute the war in Vietnam, if we were willing to leave the job unfinished because we couldn't stomach the casualties that we were taking, we encouraged him to do what he did on 9/11. We never ever want to send a mixed signal to a terrorist again. We want them to know that if they attack the United States, they're going to lose and they're going to die, and it's that easy.
I have two responses. One, of course, this was Lyndon Johnson's argument that, you know, we can basically never leave a war. Here we had a lie. In this case, it was a Democratic president, but the Gulf of Tonkin, right? Mm-hmm. That was a lie. We claimed the ship was blown up. It wasn't blown up.
It's hard to verify.
It was enough to convince Congress. Hey, remember the Maine. I mean,
The
Spanish-American War was based on a ship blowing, a boiler blowing up in a ship. Got us in a war with Spain. That one, at least, we won. But Iraq is also based on a lie. Saddam Hussein never had the WMDs. Plenty of countries have them.
He had them back in the early 90s. We knew. But what did he do with them?
Not nuclear.
He had a nuclear program. He didn't have nuclear weapons.
Right.
He had the biological and the chemical weapons. We know he had them. We know he used them against the Kurds. We know he used them against the Iranians.
Biological weapons?
A lot of people.
Yeah. Back at World War I. Right. Germany used mustard gas.
Yes, they did.
In fact, some 90 countries have those kinds of biological chemical weapons,
right.
But we don't go invading them all.
Well, they're not all run by wackos like Saddam. I mean, Saddam.
How about North Korea?
How about
Iran?
How about Saudi Arabia?
How about Somalia? How about Sudan? I mean, the list goes on and on. In Sudan, there's an active genocide going on.
Yes, there is.
And we're doing nothing about it.
And we ought to.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you agree with me on that. But war's about priorities. We can't invade every wacko that runs a country. We should, it seems to me...
No, but we can stop the wackos who have weapons of mass destruction.
But he didn't have
That's
them.
Our obligation. He did have
okay,
them.
Why
we saw
why
them.
Why didn't we stop North Korean ruler from getting weapons of mass destruction?
President Clinton was president then, you tell
no,
me.
No.
Yes,
got them
yes.
In 102. I was working
no,
in Congress
no.
at the time. No, that's when they kicked out the inspectors. They kicked them out in 01 while Bush was president. The Kim Jong-il wisely felt that we were preoccupied by September 11th and kicked out the inspectors, and our president did nothing. And he did nothing, I submit to you, because North Korea doesn't have oil.
Well, in fact, that's dead wrong, Mark, because North Korea is just as wacko, just as unstable,
absolutely.
And just as dangerous as was Saddam.
Far more, actually.
And this guy, Kim Jong-il, has to be dealt with, and he will be dealt with.
Yes, but now he has nuclear weapons. And it seems to me that we have given a lesson to the entire world, and that Iran has clearly picked up on. And the lesson is, if you don't have WMDs, like Iraq didn't, we may invade you. If you have nuclear weapons, we're going to lay low. North Korea has given that lesson loud and clear, and every dictator in the world heard it.
North Korea will be dealt with. There's no doubt that North Korea will be dealt with. It cannot stand that they will be allowed to have these weapons and, most recently, testing the means to deliver them to the United States.
You know, I hope you're right. I'm afraid it's too late. There was a time to stop North Korea. It was in 01. It was in 02. I'm afraid it's too late now. And to me, the heart of the question is, at a time when 2,500 Americans are dead, 20,000 are wounded, is what are we fighting for? If you read the secret memos sent to the president, not the ones he discloses to us, you find that it's a civil war, that men can't wear shorts, that women, that if you wear jeans, you're shot at, that they have 1 hour of power for every 6 hours they don't have power. Times in Iraq, I really hate to say it, but they were better under Saddam Hussein.
Well, certain aspects of life have not come back online as fast as we would have hoped they would, but things are getting better. We have turned a corner there.
We've turned a corner every 6 days.
Well, no.
Mission accomplished in 03.
No, we've turned
a corner with the Constitution, turned a corner with an election. We are turning backwards.
No, one of the real successes was not taking out al-Massawi. It was collecting all the documents and the computers and the treasure trove of information that was in his safe house when we took him out. The fact that that punk is dead, that's great. That's wonderful. In fact, that's good. But the information that we got out of that, and the fact that he thinks that the insurgency is losing power, and he thinks the insurgency is on the last ropes, and we found out where another 400 safe houses were, and we took 987 terrorists into custody in the next 48 hours afterwards. That's what's the key.
Here's the problem. The insurgency wasn't run by Zarqawi. Still isn't run by Zarqawi. Wasn't run by al-Qaeda. He's a bad guy.
He was one piece of it.
He's dead. He was a very small piece of it. Mostly, you have Iraqis who don't want to be occupied by the United States of America.
And they won't
be. And that's something that I fear will not change until we leave. I would suggest to you that the attacks will only stop when we leave Iraq. And that as long as we're there, we're simply drawing them on ourselves.
We are not out there. The Iraqis are taking over more and more. Just last week, the Iraqis are now up to 30,000 square miles of territory that they are primary lead in protecting. There will come a time when they are protecting the whole thing and we can fade into the woodwork.
They're not even safe in the green zone. That's what this memo says. Folks, if you want to call in, the toll-free number, 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Agree with me, agree with Mike. It's up to you, but we want to hear from you. We'll be right back after this.
Mrs. DeBruzzo, I'm Ed McMahon, and we're signing up people for...
Yes, I am.
Miss Murphy, Ed McMahon. We're starting up...
No.
Dreams really do come true.
Ed McMahon, see.
Ed McMahon.
Yes, Ed McMahon. We're having our first
Ed
ever...
Ed McMahon.
Yes. Tuesday night at the high school. We're starting up the Neighborhood Watch in this area, and here's all the information.
Stevie!
Get down here, please.
No, he's just here.
Five, six, seven, eight.
No tango dinner. Neighborhood watch. We're having this neighborhood watch, the first one.
Larry, put some pants on.
I'll come back.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Start a neighborhood watch. It's just one of the many ways you can help make America stronger. To find out how, call or log on for this free guide.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're debating the war in Iraq, something that Congress doesn't seem to like to do, but we do right here on the Inside Scoop. My guest is Mike Lane. He's the president of Intelligence Strategies. It's his job to get Republicans elected, and it's my job to elect a Congress that actually has oversight over the President of the United States. We want to hear from you, and Cynthia from McLean, Virginia, what do you have to say on this?
Well, I just turned in a little while ago, and you've already answered the question I wanted to know, because your guest, Mike, is that correct? The
first name? That's his name.
He's doing a spectacular job, absolutely spectacular.
Well, thank you, Cynthia.
The explanations are succinct and clear, couldn't be better. His composure is excellent. And I thought, wow, I need to know who is the person that's speaking so eloquently.
Well, Cynthia, why do you think we're in Iraq?
We need, exactly for all the reasons he says, as far as the weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein himself was the weapon of mass destruction. He had to go. He absolutely, positively had to go.
Well, what about the leader of North Korea, the leader of Iran, the leader of Sudan, Somalia, Saudi Arabia? They all have to go too?
I'm not smart enough to debate that with you, Mark. I'm only aware of what's going on in Iraq.
Was Saddam
the United States, the United States has absolutely got to be there. The United States has absolutely got to see it through. And I contribute every month to the Republican Party. I'm a Democrat who lived and came from Texas long, long ago, but I definitely, definitely now believe in the Republican Party 100%. And if the media persons would stop being so anti-American, I think we could get this war over a lot faster.
Really? You think that those of us that think the troops need to come home are anti-American?
Yes. In your case, I do.
Why,
I don't certainly
so?
I'm not your guest. I just called in to say that Mike is doing a spectacular job, and I hope that you'll invite him again,
again. The time, but I want to debate with you. I can't.
No,
because it's very interesting to me what you have to say, because the idea that to dissent in America, to actually think that we should bring troops home, is anti-American. I find extraordinary. Basically, you're saying that if you disagree with the president, you're un-American.
At the moment, we have got to fight the war, and the persons
Which
who are
war?
Playing most into the hands of the terrorists or the persons who are trying to undermine the United States are those of us Americans who are at home. We need to absolutely, all of us, unite 100% behind the president, behind the Congress, get this job done. The more we bicker among ourselves, the longer it's going to take.
Cynthia, let me ask you this. Who do you think is a bigger threat to you and to me, living in the Washington, D.C. area? Saddam Hussein before 03 or Osama bin Laden? Who was a bigger threat?
Probably bin Laden.
Okay. How do you feel about the fact that we have 10 times the troops in Iraq that we do in Afghanistan, that we're actually spending 10 times the money, 10 times the effort, 10 times the lives fighting Saddam Hussein, when Osama bin Laden attacked right here in Northern Virginia, killed 200 people at the Pentagon, killed 2,800 at the World Trade Center, and we've pulled resources from Afghanistan to fight Iraq? Does that concern you?
No, and I wanted to respond to your little trivial remark on the news about, well, it's all about the oil.
It doesn't
Well,
concern
so
you.
What? So what if it is about the oil? Every single one of us in the United States of America is completely, absolutely, totally dependent on oil.
On that, I agree. But
and we
change?
And so what if it is about the oil? So what?
Well,
all the more reason that we have to hurry up, fight it, and get it over with.
Well, Jimmy Carter back in the 70s tried to wean us off foreign oil. There's all kinds of Brazil, in fact, has some 40% of their cars.
Well, I actually think that's all a good idea too, but. Who among us has done it? So let's just get real and get behind the president and get behind the Congress and get behind your guest, Mike, and let's get the job done.
Well, Cynthia, I couldn't disagree with you more, but I do appreciate your call, and I appreciate your willingness to come and take me on air, and I hope you'll call again sometime.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Cynthia.
You have any comment, Mike?
Well,
it's mostly I was arguing with her. You agree with her, I think.
The only thing I wish she would have brought up is that if we would allow exploration and drilling in the Anwar, we could take one giant step towards reducing our dependence on foreign oil.
We could have oil to fund every American for 6 to 9 months.
No, no, no.
The last wilderness.
What we could do is, initially, we could have 20% of our domestic consumption could be met by Anwar. Now, that's not going
to
last forever.
6 to 9 months.
Reserves, you know, are not there.
What they're saying.
Well, let's drill. Let's do it.
Well, I got a better idea. Let's do what Brazil did. They're running 40% of their cars on sugar cane. We have soybeans. We have corn. We have Prius. Let me talk about a proposal I just talked about with a friend of mine. I want to see what you think of it.
All right.
Okay? It's a gas tax / rebate. Here's my plan. You find the median fuel efficiency. I mixed up miles per gallon and fuel efficiency. Find the median fuel efficiency. Let's say it's 20 per gallon.
Right.
All right? If you've got a Hummer, if you're getting 9 per gallon, you pay a hefty tax. But the tax doesn't go to the government. It goes to citizens who buy a Prius that gets 60 or 70. And we slowly move that median up so that over time, Americans who buy these gas guzzlers continue to buy them, but they're punished. They're punished by saying, and instead, those that buy Priuses and cars that save oil, they are rewarded. And they're rewarded by their fellow Americans. No money for the government. What that does is it encourages, it actually slowly persuades American to do the conservation we need. What do you think?
Well, let me answer you philosophically rather than practically.
Okay.
Why do we have to punish anybody? If there's a product out there that the market is offering, why shouldn't somebody be able to buy that product without punishment? Why shouldn't they be able to just do it?
Because now, I'm paying for a war in Iraq over that oil.
Okay. In the case of the Hummer, the market has spoken. The Hummer is no longer in production.
Hummer 1. There's like 2 and 3 that are still
no longer in production. They're
just
gone.
The worst,
you know?
The worst Hummer. No,
all right.
No,
so the market has spoken.
On that one car.
The market has spoken. Sales of SUVs since gasoline hit $3 a value, sales of SUVs are down 40%. The market is speaking. If the market maintains the cost of energy at the cost it is now, our fuel, our national fleet is fleet efficiency is going to increase.
But we need to help it along. Mike, here's the problem.
I'm helping it along. You know what I did to help it along?
I forgot.
I bought a scooter. You knew that.
Oh, that's right. I did know that.
110 miles to the gallon.
Kudos to Mike who bought a scooter at 110 miles a gallon. It's the most un-Republican thing you've ever done. I'm very proud of you.
And it's the only...
There is hope for your soul
now. And the only model with a standard catalytic converter on it. So it's clean, too.
There is hope for Mike Lane's soul.
I recommend it to everyone.
There's proof right there. But the problem is this, Mike. It's interesting, Cynthia from McLean, because her point was...
Very smart girl.
What if it is about oil? It's okay with me. If we're going to war for oil, it's okay. Here's the problem, Cynthia. We are spending hundreds of billions of dollars, some $8 billion a month on this war in Iraq. This is apart from 2,500 Americans dead and 20,000 wounded, which... You know, that's incalculable. But even the stuff you can calculate, that should be added to our oil cost. It seems to me, at the very least, all of that money from Iraq should come from people buying gas-guzzling cars. If you want your SUV, understand that people are dying to get you that SUV, and that sounds extreme. But in essence, while we're not moving to a policy like Brazil, like Europe, there are plenty of countries on Earth that are getting away from this dependency on oil. We're not doing it. And... frankly, the war in Iraq, as far as I'm concerned, is one of those costs.
All right. Now, let me give you the practical answer to your question instead of the philosophical one. One of the reasons, the main reason for having a tax code is to generate the money you need to run the government and to provide the services that the citizens demand. I believe in limited services. You probably believe in somewhat more expansive services. We can argue about where the proper meeting is at a different time. But one of the things that you should not use the tax code for, I don't believe, is social engineering. You shouldn't use it to incent people to do this and to penalize people for doing that. You should let the market take over. Now, I realize I've lost that war. I've lost that argument. Our entire tax code, which is how big, is nothing but one big incentive manual right there. Starting with the home mortgage interest deduction and going on to everything else, medical deductions, whatever it is. I mean, it's one big incentive code. So having lost it, is it a worthy thing to have a reduced dependence on imported oil? Yeah, I think so. I'm going to argue a little bit. I'm going to argue a little bit with the way you're going to distribute the largesse that came out of it. But I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing to penalize in some sense the real gas guzzlers. I'm not going to incent the people who are buying high-priced cars. They can buy it themselves. Let's go ahead and reduce some other tax so that people can keep their money.
The problem, Mike, is that while I agree with you in general,
make
it's
it revenue
not good
neutral.
To use tax code to incentivize things. Generally, that's the case.
It's done.
It's way done. It has been ever since 1986, the last time we had a simplification.
It's been done since 1876.
Fine. This is important. And the reason it's important is what I think people don't understand, what I don't think Cynthia McClain understands, is we are funding both sides in the war on terror. We are sending our troops and paying for that, and we're also funding the insurgents because we give billions and hundreds of billions of dollars to Saudi Arabia. They give it to the schools. They train the terrorists, and the terrorists come right there and kill Americans. We are on both sides of this war on terror. We wouldn't give a damn about the Middle East. We would treat them like we treat the Africans. Apparently, the administration doesn't care. It's all words, no action, when people are being massacred in the streets. We wouldn't care about them if they didn't have oil. And the reason we care is because we give all this money to them, and we help fund Osama bin Laden. How did Osama bin Laden get his money? He was a Saudi sheikh, and they got money from... These were people in the desert. They had no money. They were third-world countries. Our oil funds our own seeds of destruction, and until we get an alternative resource, we will continue to fund our enemies in ways that we can't possibly combat.
Well, I'll meet you halfway on a couple of those things. The first thing, I think Cynthia understands a lot of this a lot more than you give her credit for, and perhaps it's you who need to do a little bit more understanding here, Mark. But on your points, you know, it's not really our responsibility to stop the genocide going on in Sudan. It's Europe's job. They're the ones that are close. It's their sphere of influence, not our sphere of influence.
We can all work together.
But they're not doing it, and somebody needs to do it. And I'm an interventionist, and I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to go ahead and do it. I also would say that, you know, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, we also should have done it in Rwanda.
Yes,
10 years ago.
And I'm glad we did it in Kosovo.
And we should have. Yes. So somebody's got to stop it. If we're the world's policeman, I'm willing to wear that badge in more circumstances perhaps than you are. There's no doubt that we have progress that needs to be made in working with our allies, particularly our sometimes duplicitous allies, and we don't get everything we want out of Saudi Arabia and some others, but we're working with them. Diplomacy works better than force does, according to your side, and I'm willing to use diplomacy with those countries before we start a conflict.
You know, there was a time, Mike, when America was looked to as the country of freedom. Tiananmen Square, the Chinese raised the Statue of Liberty. In 2001, as recently as 5 years ago, in Iran, there were pro-American demonstrations. I think if we would show that our role is to really, if you will, police the world, to help people, rather than just trying to grab things for our corporations, then I think we could have a world where America is respected once again. But that's all the time we have. Mike, thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop. I always appreciate your debates. Thank you for your calls, Cynthia and Gordon. We are here on Channel 10 every Monday at 7 o'clock for live television talk. You don't get that much elsewhere. I'm also on the radio at www.radioinsidescoop.com, 2 o'clock Eastern Time. Check it out. Go to radioinsidescoop.com. Tomorrow, I've got a show on Iraqi veterans. You're going to hear in their own words what they think about this conflict. But that's it for now for the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine signing off.